Quorum. I'd like to ask everyone to please join me in the pledge of our flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Our compensation announcement. I have my on this day in history little comment today. President Jefferson announced the exploration of the Western United States and commissioned Lewis and Clark to find a way to travel across the United States, and that was on this day into the Pacific Ocean. And you know, many of those engineering and survey and really led to the communication, the transportation system that later served this country about 100 years later. My fellow commissioners, ABAG members, today you'll be receiving or entitled to $100 per meeting and up to a maximum of $500 per month per agency to make decisions on important transportation and land use issues that will serve future generations, such as Lewis and Clark's exploration did over 100 years ago. Their work set the foundation for the transportation explosion that would take place, and let our work today move forward in that spirit. I believe ABAG has a very similar announcement. Is someone going to make that announcement?
Yes. Fred is ready for that.
Yes, thank you. Pursuant to Assembly Bill 23, the following ABAG Administrative Committee members in attendance at the special meeting of the ABAG Administrative Committee are entitled to receive per diem in the amount of $150 as a result of convening the simultaneous or serial meeting of the MTC Planning Committee: Councilmember Julie Pierce, Supervisor Dave Cortese, Supervisor Scott Haggerty, Supervisor James Sparing. Thank you.
Thank you. Moving on to consent calendar, this is the MTC Planning Committee approval. These are the minutes. I'll entertain a motion to approve.
Move to approve.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Any dissent? That motion passes unanimously. Moving on
and
to item number
Jim,
five.
Excuse me. ABAG has a consent calendar as well.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Which consists of the summary minutes of the November 14th meeting, the administrative committee meeting of February 2nd, and adoption of Resolution 0115.
And I'll move that item.
Thank you. I have a motion by Eklund. Second by Haggerty. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Shirley. Item number five, this is the draft MTC public participation plan. And Ellen, are you going to kick this all over here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's Friday the 13th, but it's also Galentine's Day. one of my heroes, Leslie Knope from Parks and Rec, designated February 13th as Galentine's Day. So go, ladies. So this is MTC's public participation plan. Some of you are old hands at this, and some of you this is very new. But as the MPO, MTC is required to adopt a public participation plan that lays out in real broad strokes how the public can engage in the key work that we do. I think the most important part of this public participation plan is Appendix A, which deals with the coming update to Plan Bay Area. And it is written to be consistent with the focused approach to updating Plan Bay Area, so it's not a brand new thing this time. We're starting with a plan, and we're conducting the outreach accordingly. And I think it's important to note that this is not a detailed blueprint of how the meetings will be structured, where we're going to hold every meeting, specifically location and all that. That will be worked out, and we will come back regularly and check in with you on that kind of information. So this is a high-level document. It also is minimum things that we commit to do, and it doesn't mean we couldn't do more if it makes sense to do that. So just a little bit on the process. We had a meeting in October to hear ideas and suggestions from the public. We got a lot of good comments, and we released a draft in November. We heard that our late December close of comment date was not appropriate and really hard on people trying to celebrate the holidays. So we extended the comment period for a full 66 days, and the comments closed on January 12th. So we're back here. We received some between 90 and 100 comments, and they are summarized and attached to this memo, along with a response from staff. And I would just like to say that we really do appreciate the time people took to read through this document and offer their suggestions. We took a number of their ideas, and we have made some revisions. The themes that we heard were be more specific. We started out that way by really, this plan is different than the last plan that was updated in 2010. It really goes into the process for updating Plan Bay Area, each technical milestone, its significance, what the opportunities for public input will be at that phase, who's making decisions, and how it will feed the next step in the process, so people can really understand how the plan builds on each step until you have a draft plan and a draft EIR. But we also tried to call out how public comments will be considered, you know, explicitly. We commit to summarizing all the comments we get and reporting back to the decision makers at key intervals in the plan before you make the decisions, and so that you have an understanding of the range of public opinion out there, areas where there's consensus, areas where there's disagreement. And we also commit to keeping the public informed of your actions and trying to explain, if you took a different stance, why. So that's outlined in Strategy 3 of our main PPP, and then also in Appendix A. It's one of the goals for tracking our performance. We also heard that we really should do a better job of tailoring the message locally. And so we have a section in the Appendix A about how we're going to work with local government. We also commit to getting a toolkit ready so that you all can use it to tailor your message when you go out to speak to the public, as well as other people can be our ambassadors and go out and talk about Plan Bay Area. Let's see. We got a lot of comments about the need to involve underserved communities. In particular, there was a request that we heard to reconvene a group that we had last time, the Regional Equity Working Group. Since it was so popular, we decided to go ahead and add that back in. So we will have a Regional Equity Working Group to advise staff on the equity and environmental justice provisions of the plan. We got a lot of interesting ideas from the public about how to improve access to meetings, and we are going to work hard to try and think out of the box on that. There are minimum requirements for public meetings, and we will by all means meet those, and we're looking for ways to improve interactivity so people don't necessarily have to come to a meeting to comment. So we could go out where people are, or we could offer more online, so we're looking at that. A lot of people also wanted us to, you know, learn from the past, evaluate, improve. We do have a consultant on board, Barbary Coast Consulting, and they're going to help us try and simplify our message so that it's more understandable to a lay audience. And we will be back to you possibly as early as next month with a strategy to kick off the public engagement for Plan Bay Area, which we hope to do in May with a round of public meetings. There were also a number of comments really specific to the work that Ken and Miriam and their staffs will do on Plan Bay Area, and they were a little bit beyond the scope of our public participation plan. But we, when possible, we tried to tell people in our response, you know, at what point in that process they could engage on their particular issue. So we are recommending approval of the draft. Final draft PPP. There are a number of revisions in response to comments that are shown in strike through and underscore. We also, there's a pink handout at your chairs. This was a late addition from the Federal Transit Administration. They wanted us to specifically name the different transit operators that we will be that receive federal funding through our program of projects. So all it is adding the names of the transit operators. So we would like to incorporate this as part of the recommendation and have it move. We'll fix this between now and when we go to the full commission for approval. And then I'd also like to ask Brad Paul from ABAG to offer his suggestions and comments.
Thank you, Ellen. I just wanted to support the proposal before you and to let you know that ABAG staff has been involved in the preparation of this plan and support it. I say that as the person who authored a memo back in December that caused a little bit of confusion because of the title. It was called Public Outreach Plan, and it should have said Public Outreach Strategy. But there was some discussion, as you all remember, that was there one plan or two plans? I'm here to say there is only one plan, and we have been working closely with MTC staff in the second revision of the plans before you today, and we fully support it and look forward to working with all of you going forward to implement this plan as we go along. Thank you.
Okay, what I'd like to do, committee members, I have two speaker cards. I'd like to take both of these and then bring it back to the committee for discussion. And so the first one will be Dwayne DeWitt. Dwayne?
Hello, my name is Dwayne DeWitt. I'm from Roseland up in southwest Santa Rosa. It's known officially in some quarters as a disadvantaged, underserved, unincorporated county area. And I've taken the time here in the past to come and advocate on its behalf with both the board of ABAG and the MTC, trying, perhaps in a bit naive and uninformed manner as a citizen, a guy that's ridden buses all his life and every transportation policy system that there is here in this 9-county area, wanting to make sure that somehow we can have a good outcome for this area up in Sonoma County. Over the years, it's been possible for it to become now a priority development area. But at the same time, it's lost its focus of right near the commercial corridor, near a railroad that's now restarting called the Sonoma Marin Area Rail Transit. And they've expanded it so wide that the city of Santa Rosa and some other entities are looking at this as a bit of a honeypot, a way to get some funding and perhaps not really follow what you folks are trying to propose with transit-oriented development, with good comprehensive planning, and with an approach for this One Bay Area plan to actually achieve its goals. They're just seeing some money and revitalizing an old, outdated 20-year Southwest area plan and saying, oh, hey, we got a Roseland-specific plan now, and we're going to move forward. You folks can be the body that focuses in and makes these people who've gotten some money from you in the past abide by what you're actually looking to do. A guy like me who just rides the bus, they don't care diddle squat about me. But perhaps you folks could have them pay attention and follow what it is you want them to get done with the money you've given them. Thank you for your time. I'll come back during the legislative meeting also. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. DeWitt. Good comments. Ken Brokowski, Ken.
Morning, Commissioners. As you know, I video record these meetings. Well, when I look at the public participation process and they say, well, we'll do video as funding allows, I mean, I'm doing this for nothing. I can't even get MTC to put links to the videos in the minutes. Why not? I mean, it's a record of the minutes. Why not put it in there? ABAG, to their credit, they do that, and I thank them for it. But I think video is probably the first thing you ought to do for public participation. Well, the local jurisdictions have video. Why not the regional? And I know you're going to get it next year, but it's important. I think it should be happening now, and I'm happy to do this, so thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ken. Okay, I'd like to bring the discussion back to the committee. Ellen, you know, I appreciate you pointed out that this is not a detailed document, but could you expand a little bit about how we can customize these meetings in the local jurisdictions? I mean, what are your thoughts on, you know, because each county is very uniquely different, and how some of these presentations are made is important. And so what were the thoughts there? I noticed in the document, you know, you referenced these customized meetings and trying to meet some of the local needs on how it's presented?
Well, I know that Ken and his staff have been talking to the CMA planning directors, and I believe that there's agreement that they will participate in the meetings we're having in May, for example. We're envisioning a workshop format or an open house format where people can come up and ask questions of staff, get specific information before they weigh in and comment and so forth. So we want to focus, you know, work with the county congestion management agencies on the transportation piece, and then on the local land use piece, it really is, it's a locally driven process, and we haven't gotten into a lot of detail at our level yet. We're trying to get through this plan, but I believe we want to partner with localities and, you know, talk about how the plan supports local, locally adopted priorities, local policies, voter-approved measures, and so forth.
Okay. Can we make sure that we contact the ABAG representatives of each one of those counties and those jurisdictions so they're in the loop as to what the planning process is with the CMAs, that it's not done in isolation? Okay, I'd like to go ahead and what I'll do.
Just to clarify that staff is working together on this, and I think what Ellen said is exactly right, that we're trying to approach this somewhat differently than the last time around, so that in a given county, the county priorities, the local priorities, many of which, as you know, align with Plan B Area, that we lead with that and we provide information about what's going on in a given county and how it relates to the regional plan as opposed to the other way around.
Well, that's why I raised this issue, and I wanted everyone to know that flexibility is built into this document. So so what I'd like to do is I'll just come around, but if you want to join in later, that's fine. But Eric, did you want to comment?
Yeah, I wanted to thank staff for making it really digestible with 100 comments, really easy to follow. I really am appreciative that the Public Health Coalition and the Equity Coalition's suggestions of continuing the regional equity working group is, I think that's a really important part of it, so I'm really appreciative of that. I think Barbary Coast is a great agency to help us with messaging and framing as well, so I'm very happy with the report.
Thank you. Pat?
Thank you very much, Chair Spearing. First, I want to compliment both ABAG and MTC staff for putting together a public participation plan for Plan Bay Area Appendix A that gives us that flexibility to be able to adapt the public outreach for each of the respective counties, since we're all different. We're similar, but we're all different. So really, thank you very much for doing that. I did note some internal inconsistencies between the narrative and Attachment B, which I've gone through with Ellen. And I believe that Ellen believes that these are minor typos that can be made without any recirculation, but I'll let Ellen respond to that.
Just to clarify, there were a couple, the attachment, which is the major roles and responsibilities.
Ellen, what page are we talking about?
It's the
page 32.
Okay, that's fine. Go ahead.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's like at the very end. It's after the process graphic. Attachment B, Roles and Responsibilities, 2017 Plan Bay Area. It's this one here.
Yeah.
And there are a couple places where the text in each of these steps is inconsistent with what's here, so we will be consistent with what's in the text, and we'll adapt this chart to reflect.
Okay, so you'll change the chart
to be consistent with the text. Okay. Yeah.
And I really appreciate that, because I intend to use this chart as a mechanism to help the public understand what are the major tasks associated with the Plan Bay Area update, and then who are the decision makers, so that they can understand how this is all going to work. The other thing, Chair Spearing, is that I understand that there's going to be a more detailed implementation strategy developed to help guide us on how we're going to really engage the public. And I think it's really important for this joint body to have a discussion about that implementation strategy, so that we all get buy-in and we know what our roles are going to be, and we can all make sure that we're all going in the same direction. I'd suggest that we start on that at one of our joint meetings, our next joint meetings, but that's a really up to the chairs of the respective committees.
No, I think that's a good suggestion, and we'll agendize it for our next meeting, but I think it's a discussion that needs to take place, and so I appreciate that comment.
Agreed. Appreciate that very much, and thank you very much.
All right.
Great job.
All right, Deb?
Just wanted to make two quick comments. One is that at the ABAG board meeting, we had tremendous discussion, and I'm very happy that it was moving towards, very positively towards, making sure that the plan does not appear, the new plan does not appear to be top-down, but rather a combination of the top and the bottom considerations all taken into account. And we have already discussed in terms of how we're going to reach and involve public, and by public I mean both residents as well as jurisdictions, local jurisdictions. And in that light, I would like to suggest for consideration more formal approach to specifying how the local plan inputs or comments, as we have already agreed to, were included or not included, for what reason, in the plan, final version, as well as the useful data and references that could be useful to that local jurisdiction already brought out of the plan into that, if you will, an appendix for that particular area. So it could be at the county level or on the local jurisdiction level or whatever, regional level, that's not the point. But I'm saying let's have something, the plan not just sitting on a shelf on somebody's office, but being used as a reference and as a use to guide the newcomers into the planning groups of various jurisdictions. And the second point I would like to make is that the performance monitoring that we are looking at right now is very important. Plan is one document as a start of a procedure, but actually implementation and reaching the goals is very important as well. Perhaps we have some more time to discuss that aspect of the plan, but there might be some aspects of performance monitoring that may impact our initial makeup of the plan and the way we are communicating. So I would just like to create some sensitivity to what we are going to do with the plan after it's finished in order to make sure that early on our efforts include those considerations. Thank you.
No, good comments. Julie?
Yeah, and that level of detail probably doesn't need to be in the PPP.
Right.
It certainly needs to be part of our strategy going forward as to how we're going to develop the final plan for
that.
The 2017 adoption. So those are good suggestions. Thank you.
Okay. Coming down. Jake?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of comments. One, I do believe from reading this that it does represent a joint approach to this problem. In other words, this is not an MTC deal and then a separate ABAG deal, but this is a coming together of the two agencies so that the meetings that are being conducted jointly. So just so that there's no confusion about this, there certainly was confusion at the turn of the year, and comments were made at the ABAG Executive Committee, which reflected that. So I believe I'm very pleased at what I read. I would just comment about one topic on page 19, ABAG delegate meetings. I know because I've attended them in Sonoma County. The last paragraph says that ABAG staff will conduct a second and third round of delegate meetings with elected officials over the next 2 years to continue learning about local issues and challenges. I would suggest in the spirit of ecumenism, an ecumenical fashion of working together, that MTC staff be represented at these meetings just to continue that spirit of cooperation, Mr. Chair. These are my comments. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Oh, David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you to staff for both agencies for the excellent presentation. Just a couple of quick follow-ups. on a couple of points that were raised in the comments. In terms of the equity working group, sort of what's the timing of that in terms of when you think that would reconvene? And then second, if you can speak more about the issue of reaching out to monolingual speakers, non-English monolingual speakers, and how you intend to do that. And I know that one of the strategies is to work with community-based organizations. So if you can say a little bit more about that, that would be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, actually, thank you for reminding me. I meant to touch on the work that we do with community-based organizations. We actually have a proposal out on the street just released, I think, Wednesday. We're seeking assistance from groups who work in low-income communities and communities of color to assist us with reaching out to these underserved communities. And we've done this for, I think this is the fourth or fifth plan that we've partnered with CBOs on. We give many grants, and it's been a really good process, and it's a way for us to hear from communities that might not otherwise participate. So, you know, maybe I'll send a email and a link to y'all. So if you know of groups that you think would be good to work with, you can make them aware. In terms of the equity working group, I believe that they will start getting involved in the goals because equity is one of the goals, but I'll defer to Ken on that.
An exact date hasn't been set, but they're slated to reconvene this spring.
Okay, is there further discussion? Okay. I think that Ellen, did staff have anything else they want to add on this? I'm sorry. Yeah, Mr. Haggerty does have a comment.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Under the more access to meetings and then the meeting issue, I think one of the criticisms we got is evident, like right now. It's really not convenient for the public to be here on a Friday. So, and I realize through the comments of the chair about each locale kind of or each county developing their own outreach, not their own outreach plan, but, you know, when's it convenient for their constituents. But it seems to me that I realize ABAG's meetings are at night, although now they're having one during the day and they're discussing this. Can we do something to push more of these meetings towards the nighttime as opposed to during the day? I think one of the biggest criticisms we got last time is people felt, and I don't necessarily disagree, but I do, I mean, this is when we have the meetings, I get that, but they felt we weren't being transparent. They felt we were being kind of sneaky, and by having these meetings during the day only kind of fueled that fire. So, or in the morning, which I prefer, by the way, but to me, it seems like we might want to consider more night meetings. I don't really see that addressed in the plan.
We do all the meetings that are intended to get public comments for the plan that are out in the community. Those are either in the evening or sometimes we've had them on Saturdays. And all your joint meetings where there was a big decision, you may recall those are special meetings that we held in the evening. In terms of, you know, how MTC and ABAG conduct their committee business and so forth, I can't really speak to that. But we do want to make this accessible. We're looking at ways, like maybe just have a pop-up meeting out in a community, you know, a more informal meeting, so it's not so boring. It's people are already out at an event, and they can come to a station and review our material and tell us what they think, that kind of thing. I think will really improve access as well as the web, and we're looking at streaming, live streaming of meetings to the extent that we have the resources to do that.
Yeah, I get all that. What I would say is I think staff should use their best judgment. I mean, sometimes, for example, today really would not necessitate a night meeting. But other times when you're talking about very distinct criteria that may affect people that, quite frankly, elect us, I think, you know, staff should use their best judgment and think, well, you know what, maybe this meeting should be held at night. And I realize we won't have that discussion at ABAG because ABAG's meetings are held at night, but MTC's are not.
Yeah, we can bring that back for discussion too on our agenda and how we structure those meetings. Ellen, I want to compliment the staff on how you responded to many of the comments that we received. You know, it's kind of refreshing that you know, we actually point out some of the places where you say we respectfully disagree, and you actually explain why. I really appreciate that. And you know, I think one of the problems that we've had in the past is that we did receive comments and the public just didn't think we even read them. And so the fact that we're responding to them, I think, is very good for this process, whether we agree or disagree. And the level of detail, I appreciate. And I think it needs to be at that level so people clearly understand why we either disagree or agree. The one thing on the I noticed up on the response to the MTC composition, we really should add in there to where they are approved by either the Board of Supervisors or the Mayor's Conference. You really need to expand on that so it doesn't look like, you know, there is a process within that county that uh-huh. commissioner is appointed. And so I really think that needs to be expanded so that there's a better understanding that there is a process.
Okay.
And other than that, does anyone have any other?
One more.
Yes.
I meant to say, by the way, good job. So I want to make sure I get that in. And then in the reports, never mind. I'm not going to ask the question.
Well, thank you, Scott.
Good.
I'll entertain a motion. Do we have a motion and a second? We'll take two votes. Is that correct? ABAC? Somebody from ABAC respond? Okay.
A motion by Rabbit. Second by Gupta for ABAG.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second from the MPC Planning Committee. We have a motion and a second from the ABAG representatives. All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Opposed? That motion passes unanimously. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Staff, this a very good job and very good presentation. Thank you.
Chair Spearing, do we need a motion to direct staff to come back at the next meeting to talk about the implementation?
No, I will see that's agenda.
Okay.
We will
Thank
agenda.
You.
We don't need to take a formal action on that. And staff knows, but that will be agendized. Okay. Thank you. Okay, moving on to item number 6. This is the priority development area criteria. And doesn't look like Doug Johnson's in the room.
No, Doug was unable to make it, but Doug and I co-made the presentation, and I'm going to try to channel him on a couple of these slides here.
All right. Hang on one second. Chandler, sure. Are you going to?
Yeah, I'll just kick things off. So this is, just to clarify, this is a follow-up on a discussion at the ABAG Executive Board in early January where the transit criteria and other criteria for priority development areas was discussed. They are seeking MTC's input on that criteria. This is not an MTC action. This is information and input from MTC to the ABAG Administrative Committee and a recommendation from staff to the ABAG Administrative Committee on the transit criteria. So with that, I'll have Mark walk us through it.
So just a little bit about the structure of the presentation and the discussion. The first thing we wanted to do was go over the PDA framework, looking at its history, then really zoom into the transit criteria. There's a series of criteria, which we'll talk about in a second, but the request by the ABAG Executive Board was that we talk about this one in particular, as well as going into the requested action that Ken just mentioned. So the basics of the PDA program, most of you are probably familiar with it, go back to the Focus Initiative in 2000 and 2008, a integrated regional effort between ABAG, MTC, and the other regional partner agencies to look at how we could better link our transit investments with our development patterns so that we could put people in places where they could walk to transit, where workers could have access to more transportation options. And this really was something that provided flexibility for local jurisdictions to create places, create PDAs that reflected their local plans and reflected the local geographies. So it's a 100% voluntary process, locally nominated, regionally adopted. Today we have over 190 PDAs throughout the region. The outcomes of the program to date, starting with the Focus program, there have been a series of grants supporting successful local planning. So the idea was you designate a PDA, it reflects an adopted local plan, If it doesn't, then there's a regional program that will help provide resources to adopt these plans. So through these planning efforts, what we've done is help regionally is created standards for 66,000 new housing units, 50 million square feet of commercial floor space, and 110,000 jobs. Of course, not all of these have been built yet, but this is the framework that's been created through the planning grants that have been pushed forward in the region. And following this, Plan Bay Area investments have also supported PDA planning and growth. So if you look at the performance-based plan-based framework used to assess the transit investments in Plan Bay Area, they really looked at the PDAs as a structuring element and a way of assessing performance. And then this is also a framework for related regional collaboration. So when we look at our efforts working with the Air District, BCDC, when we also look at some of the upcoming funding opportunities, we're still using the PDAs as kind of a common framework, and it's helped provide organizing elements to continue to talk about the land use of the region as it relates to a series of other issues beyond transportation. So the role of today's discussion, I think Ken really went over this, but going back, after Plan Bay Area, ABAG staff were directed to just take a review of the PDA program. Okay, the PDA program's been around for a while. Let's just kind of look at the criteria and the guidelines again and see if they still make sense. Our assessment was that they still do make sense because they provide a lot of flexibility region-wide, and they've been really supported in a lot of communities throughout the region, and we talked about some of the success of the planning program. We recommended that they be retained to our regional planning committee. The regional planning committee did take that recommendation and went to the executive board suggesting that they continue the current criteria, or adopt our recommendation that there not be any changes to those criteria. So today's discussion is specifically around transit. We'll talk about what those are in a moment. The executive board asked that there be an opportunity to talk about the transit criteria in this particular context because of the inextricable relationship to MTC's work and our transportation investments with the way the PDA program has developed and with the standards in the PDA program related to transit. And so as a result of the recommendation today that we're going to ask for, there would be executive board action at the next ABAG meeting. So what are the PDA criteria? The first two really are joint criteria. And the first one is area, so that's just the planning area being proposed for designation, that be identified and mapped by the community. And that needs to be within an existing urbanized area, which means it has existing or planned infrastructure to support development. There's already development within the boundaries of the PDA, or it lies within an urban growth boundary or limit line if one's been established. The next part, housing. The local jurisdiction is planning for a significant increase in housing units or is committed to adopting a plan which will do that, including affordable housing. And the fourth one is near transit, the focus of our discussion, which is that the area is typically a half mile around an existing rail or ferry terminal, a bus station providing service during peak periods with headways of at least 20 minutes, so it comes every 20 minutes, or the other option is that there be a future station defined as a planned improvement by MTC's Resolution 3434. So let's go back and talk about the history of the half mile for a second and the history of how this became part of the PDA program. In 2005, a lot of you are already familiar with this, but MTC adopted its transit-oriented development policy, and that followed the more than $10 billion investments from Resolution 3434, which supported the Sonoma-Marin rail transit system. It supported East Bay BRT. It supported the first parts of BART to San Jose. So the idea there, and this was really an innovative thing in the Bay Area, but also in the country, which was to say, and it sounds obvious, but we're making these major transportation investments. Let's make sure they're built in places where there's going to be enough housing and jobs to really make them cost effective. So that's where that policy went in place, and that really set the stage for, and then, so as a result of that, there was a requirement that within half mile of the new transit investments, through 3434, there be a minimum density reached. And that density was based on a host of peer-reviewed research that we'll talk about in a moment. And then that was the basis for the PDA program when it was put in place in 2007, 2008, which was a continuation of that integration of transit investments with the growth pattern. So going in a little bit to where the half mile came from, kind of conceptually, that's a 10-minute walk at 3 miles per hour. So for me, I can walk in about 8 minutes. My mother-in-law takes about 14 minutes. So it depends on the person. But the way this came kind of into common parlance, and it's been used by transportation agencies since the late 19th century in many cases to figure out how far people are likely to walk to transit. It's kind of an intuitive thing. But in the 1980s and 1990s, we had a growing interest in transit-oriented development. And so we had urban designers going back and looking at the historic patterns of cities where there was successful growth around transit stations. And then going into the 1990s and 2000s, we had the opportunity to really do rigorous peer review research. So you had researchers across the country looking at, you know, the likelihood that people will take transit within a certain distance of a home or workplace, taking into account factors such as age and income. And so this is really the rigorous work that's done at universities and research centers. And they found that we are much more likely to take transit if we can walk within 10 minutes or less. And so the most authoritative study recently was a 2012 analysis published by the Transportation Research Board, which looked at ridership data from the areas around more than 1,400 high-capacity transit stations in 21 regions, including the Bay Area. The authors found that, and they suggested, that a 1/4 mile radius around stations for jobs and a 1/2 mile radius for homes are reasonable thresholds for policies attempting to support ridership. So that kind of tells us that a 1/2 mile is relatively conservative for jobs based upon some of the analysis been done. But again, there's been an emphasis on flexibility. And some of the other related peer review research that I just wanted to mention in the last few years, Bay Area cities served by BART residents living near rail stations were around 5 times as likely to commute by rail transit than the average resident worker in the city. So really a substantial difference, and that speaks to the cost effectiveness. Also, Californians living within 1/2 mile of a transit station were 4 times more likely to use transit than those living within 1/2 mile and 3 miles of transit. And then one more, there was a study showing that 52.3% of previous automobile commuters switched to transit after moving within a 1/2 mile transit station. So again, that's based on peer-reviewed rigorous research, and that's kind of how we came to the standard. Really, a lot of this was done by MTC, and I talked to Doug to see what the state of practice is, and he helped kind of provide the input to this part of the presentation. So another thing to note here is that this criteria has become central to state policy as well and has become central to the funding opportunities that are available. So if we look at cap and trade, affordable housing, and sustainable communities, they also use a 1/2 mile radius with a similar transit standard, a slightly more rigorous transit standard. This is the same standard that the state infill affordable housing bill requires. And then if we look at some of the recent legislation, SB 375 and SB 743, which provides CEQA streamlining opportunities, again, it's homes within 1/2 mile of transit. So this kind of illustrates why it's a little faint here, but this illustrates why 1/2 mile really is a little bit conservative, because what is a 1/2 mile? If you are in downtown Oakland and you have a finely grained street network with small blocks, you can actually walk potentially 10 miles if you draw a 1/2 mile circle. If you're in another place where there really isn't that developed street network, and that's common in a lot of parts of the Bay Area, then you really can't walk 10 minutes. It might take you 20 minutes. It might even take you much longer if you got across the freeway. So I think what the purpose of the PDA planning program is to say, within a 1/2 mile radius, this is kind of an envelope in which people can have this level of convenience. And if we put these PDAs in place and make them focal points for investment, we can start to build those transit facilities. But beyond the PDAs, the OBAG program really recognized the importance of linking communities to transit. So that's why funding went for projects that connect to PDAs. So those projects can be well beyond a half mile of the station. Those can be bike. Those can be PED improvements that allow people that might live 2-3 miles away to access the amenities of the PDA as well as the transit station. And then providing one example from the region, here we see Windsor, and that little triangle there is part of kind of the vibrant downtown that some of you might have seen with some recent development. And it's the location of one of the future Sonoma Marin rail transit stations. And so we can see where that is, and then we can see a half-mile buffer around it. Now, if we just said you can only, your PDA has to actually be within a half mile, then, you know, you couldn't have a PDA like this. Your PDA like this is consistent with the geography of the community, and that's the reason, and the planning framework of the community, and that's the reason why the PDA standard is typically, that the area of the PDA be typically a half mile. So there is an opportunity for slight deviations here, and that's to, but that has to recognize the local planning context, and there's definitely been reasonable guidelines applied here. So if we doubled the area and it was 2 miles away, I mean, that it'd be hard to make the argument that it's typically. So that's been the application of the standard. We think it's been something, based on the review, that's been worked relatively consistently throughout the region. So after taking a look at everything, we're recommending that the ABAG Executive Board retain the current PDA criteria without modification, and that is a recommendation that the Administrative Committee would take today. Ken, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
No, I think you covered it all pretty thoroughly. I mean, we have over 190 PDAs at this point. They incorporate most of the transit-served areas within the region, and the transit criteria, the half-mile transit criteria that the Executive Board at ABAG put in place, as Mark suggested, is already pretty generous. There's flexibility around OBAG for areas beyond that to utilize funding through the OBAG program. And the half mile does, as Mark said, it syncs up with a number of other regional and state policies, including SB 375. The new cap and trade funding coming out of the state uses a half mile distance to transit stations. So we think this is a good place to be, and it makes sense to stay the course at this level.
Okay. Mr. Haggerty?
Yeah, excuse my ignorance on this. I'm trying to understand what's going on here procedurally. Is this now an ABAG discussion? Is this an ABAG and MTC discussion? Is it an ABAG MTC discussion with ABAG taking action? What's going on here?
I would not say that has anything to do with ignorance. It's very confusing, and that's sort of the structure we have. ABAG is seeking input from MTC commissioners on this matter, which is why it's being brought to this joint committee. The priority development areas were not adopted by MTC, although they influence many MTC programming activities and planning activities, obviously. They're adopted by ABAG. So the recommendation goes, and the input from MTC goes to the ABAG Administrative Committee to then recommend back to their executive board, which will adopt the PDA criteria and any changes they might consider. So they're seeking MTC's input, but it's an ABAG action.
So will ABAG actually be taking action today?
Yes, it will be a recommendation to our executive board.
All right, thank you. I know there's a lot of people smarter in this room, but I'm just trying to figure this out. So is this policy, or first of all, this whole quarter mile, this is extremely interesting to me. This is, I think, the first time it's ever been mentioned, and maybe it's one way to get the people that are saying that it should be a mile off the mile and maybe back to the half mile. I'm not sure the way this is being played today, but I do find the quarter mile interesting now. But having said that, I'm really disappointed because obviously I must be the only one here that lives in Dublin that sees people walking a mile to BART stations. I see high-density housing within a mile of a BART station in a community that is thriving, both walking. But one of the things your report missed the most is you totally ignore those who are biking. And I guess when, you know, with the increases in biking that we've seen, I'm not quite sure why we wouldn't talk about that. So, but having said that, Is this at odds with ABAG's understanding of the half mile? Because when I had people in my office talking about this, they were basically saying, no, if the transit center's here, as long as you're within a half mile going this way, the PDA applies. But now we're going back to this criteria that says, MTC's criteria that says, no, we put it in the middle, we make the circle a mile, or a half mile, but in reality, it's really only a quarter mile, which is really nothing. This board never voted on, MTC never voted on that. MTC never voted on a quarter mile. It was staff's interpretation then to go back and just put a circle around it. So again, Mary, I'm respectfully asking you, does this conflict with our policy?
Maybe we didn't explain things appropriately, or the graphic of the circle was meant to show that it doesn't have to follow the circle, that the way our streets are laid out, it doesn't follow a circle, and there is flexibility to go beyond the half mile. The circle was reflecting the half mile. We can go beyond the half mile because that's how the local plans are created. What we're trying to explain here is whether the half mile makes sense or whether we should consider the 1 mile or any other alternative. The question was between the half mile and the 1 mile. And the reason why there's reference to the quarter mile, that's only because in previous MTC research, that was a consideration. You're correct. We never approved or adopted the quarter mile. The discussion was around the half mile. So I think we're on the same page. If we didn't express in our graphic the point correctly, let me clarify. It's not meant to be a perfect circle, but to follow the walking patterns, the biking patterns that we have around a transit node or a transit corridor, and be flexible to accommodate the specific local needs and local plans.
Okay. Miriam, can I add one thing to that?
Hang on a second.
I need to stay in this because I need to understand this. And somebody keeps turning me off, or this mic's not working very well. Can you go back to that one slide that showed Windsor and with the PDA? That circle there. If I took that circle and I put a pin there and then I put a string, is that string, I need this clarification, would this be a quarter mile or half mile from the circle to the edge of the circle?
Half mile.
That's okay, so if you, the middle of that circle to the outer part of the circle, so if you took it and you just went across, that would be a full mile?
Correct.
Okay, good. That's helpful. Now, if I took that PDA and see where it's a point up there?
Correct.
And I brought that point all the way down to the circle. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Correct.
That's outside
of the circle. That's beyond the half mile, but it's kind of
what the plan is.
Yes.
Okay. Does MTC agree with that?
To quote Justice Scalia, it's close enough for government work. Yeah, we do. The point here is that PDAs aren't circles. They follow geographic
demarcations.
Well, I get
that, this has been the misunderstanding then. And so
At the same time, you can abuse any exception, right? So,
well, I don't want to abuse it. I want to understand it.
What I'm saying is, in this case, you've got a pretty close fit. There are obviously cases that you could design where you have a much less close fit and only a small little intersection. And I think that's where the smell test wouldn't quite be passed.
So let me smell this for a minute. If I took that, again, I just want to be clear, Steve. I really just me and you talking right now. If I take that point.
Forget the rest of these people.
Forget everybody else in here.
You know, we're transparent, okay?
We're being transparent. You take this point and you push it all the way down. So that point up there is now just the top of the PDA or where the transit center is.
Right.
Okay. So what's happened is now everything else is kind of shifted down.
Yep.
So that further part that is already out of the PDA is now being probably pushed about a half mile further down. Correct?
Right.
Is that acceptable?
I think that's a lot closer call, frankly, because you would probably be putting about half the PDA outside of a half a mile. And the reason the quarter mile is important, it wasn't just MTC research. It's really national research that suggests that a quarter mile is really where you have the best fit and the best chance of maximizing biking and walking to the station. We pushed it out from that because we didn't want to be as restrictive. The further you push it out, the more likely you are to reduce those opportunities. Because, again, PDAs aren't circles, and people don't fly. They walk, they wait for traffic lights, they got to find a sidewalk if there isn't one. So I think the notion of getting too broad with the definition sort of runs into the reality that not everybody is in great shape. You know, not everybody rides a bike. Some people take a lot longer to walk than others. And so we think the half mile is a good compromise.
But if somebody came into you with that PDA pushed down further, it is something you would accept or you would consider.
Well, I'd certainly consider it, and it, again, it mostly would be ABAG considering it, and we work together on these issues. But I think the example that you're postulating, I think, is coming close to breaking the mold.
Well, okay.
And again, it's not about where the lines are on a map. It's about how many people are going to walk and bike. I mean, it's really about trying to encourage that activity.
I tried to walk up the hill I live on the other night and almost died. So, and that was less than a, that wasn't even a tenth of a mile. So, I mean, you're off,
not.
Steve. Okay, well, thank you. I think the discussion has been helpful, and I appreciate it. So I think it does make a little bit clearer for me.
I'm assuming that you're going to look at how it functions, and that would be the exception. You know, so if you got out beyond that, and people could still get there in a short period of time.
Yeah, I do think these cases are very unique and specific to the location. And I can imagine plenty of locations where a half a mile is crazy. No one's going to walk it. I could imagine locations where they'll walk longer than that. So we've tried not to be too rigid. We've tried to compromise, and I'm sure ABAG would evaluate these on a case-by-case basis and try to exercise good judgment.
Okay. Scott Wehner, and then Alicia and Pat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a few questions.
Discussion. No.
I understand that the creation of PDAs is purely voluntary on behalf of the cities. We local control over zoning, whatever the pros and cons of that may be. What's the experience been? So we see 190 PDAs. What's the experience been in terms of where they should be versus who's coming forward and volunteering? Are there areas that staff believes really should be PDAs that the communities have not wanted to do that? So, for example, is every single Caltrain station in a PDA? I mean, it should be. And for example, and if what are the are there any consequences for not forming a PDA when there should be one? For example, and I know I've talked about this before and I'm like a broken record, the transit funding needs to follow housing creation. And if a community refuses to create housing, it becomes, I think, challenging for them to argue we want a lot of transit money. And then once a PDA is formed, what are the accountability mechanisms for making...
Hey, Scott. Just a second. I mean, Scott's trying to talk to Marion, so let him.
That's okay.
If you would let him, because he's asking a question.
And once a PDA is formed, what are the accountability mechanisms for saying that they're actually going to follow through and there will be housing created in those PDAs? So I know it's a lot, but is there questions?
Some of that analysis actually is done in the PDA investment and growth strategy reports that the CMA planning staff have prepared. So while I don't recall, I won't go into the details, there are very few areas that will be left for PDA consideration in terms of transit accessibility, but there are some. Not all BART stations are PDAs. But as you pointed out, it's a combination of the transit component, the existing infrastructure, as well as the desire to place housing, to produce housing in those locations. So there are some locations where housing is not a priority, and those places have not been proposed by the local jurisdictions as priority development areas.
What BART stations are not PDAs?
North Berkeley. But in general, there are very few places, based on the analysis that MTC and ABAC have done about transit accessible areas throughout the region and the overlap with the priority development areas.
I'd be interested to see a list of any BART or Caltrain stations that are not PDAs.
The same thing in San Francisco. The west side of San Francisco has a lot of transit accessibility, but it's not designated as priority development areas. But in general, we can show you that map. There are not a lot of areas. In terms of the success in actual production of housing, we did a survey in 2013, and it's approximately 60% of... Is that correct? 60% of multifamily housing within priority development areas. So it's probably higher than what we expected, given that we are just recovering in housing production. So we have seen an increase in both PDA and multifamily housing.
And so are we? Is ABAG monitoring? Okay, here are the 190 PDAs. How many units are actually being produced? How many are in the pipeline? What is the zoning situation in terms of allowing for that?
We're moving in that direction. In 2000, last year, we did inventory, but at this point, many of our jurisdictions are not necessarily equipped to share information on a regular basis. There are a few cities that have a very functional pipeline database. The expectation is that we are able to support the jurisdictions in developing their own pipeline database that then can be connected at the regional level. So given the fact that we have to collect manually data for some of the PDA jurisdictions, we're probably going to be doing that on annual basis or as resources allow. But the expectation is in the next 3 years to build a regional pipeline database that will allow us to create that type of record on more regular basis.
Okay, and we'll have access to that?
Sorry?
We'll have access to that reporting?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it will be an online tool that it will be open to elected officials, local jurisdictions, developers, of course.
Thank you.
May I add one further point? Every PDA was, when it was originally created, was vetted by the Regional Planning Committee and the ABAG Executive Board. So a lot of the flexibility that are in the community plans that were designated priority development areas were hashed out in the discussion. Furthermore, we have a distinction between a planned PDA and a potential PDA. A planned PDA, which is much more eligible for funding from the OBAG process, has conformed zoning to the densities that on the nomenclature was built under. Obviously, we're trying to get more density for more transit usage. And in the suburban communities where these become more difficult to actually build, we have a vision of a certain level of density in proximity to a transit station. Now, the key point for having a PDA is that the local jurisdiction will support projects coming through there that have conformed zoning. And if we find that the local government is not doing that, then the CMAs in their administration of the OBAG funding will act accordingly. Furthermore, we have a RENA process, which operates partially through the PDA framework, but also looks at these sort of opportunity areas that local governments have not committed to. And the fact that they don't have PDAs does not exempt them from RENA requirements. It certainly makes them get scrutinized in a more in a closer way. The RENA process is really the only state enforcement tool for trying to generate more zoning for housing.
If I could just quickly conclude, and the reason I ask is about the BART and Caltrain stations. This applies in San Francisco as well. It applies to any transit-rich area. I think it's we're correctly investing huge amounts in BART and in Caltrain, and we should. They have to be bulked up. They're not, don't have the right capacity, and I'm 1,000% supportive of that. But as we make those investments, I think it's incredibly unfair if you have communities that actually have their own BART station or their own Caltrain station right there with potentially lower ridership at that station, and it's very lovely to wait on that platform because very few people are there, as opposed to the areas that actually have stepped up or producing the housing and have stations that are overcrowded, where you know hard to get onto the train there. And so, again, I know it's a conundrum because of local control, and but that it just seems like a real issue to look at because we're not. It's one thing when you say we're going to put a station there and we're going to condition it on you zoning in a certain way. When you have these long-standing stations in a local community that will not add any housing, that strikes me as a challenge.
So, for example, Rockridge in Oakland is not a PDA, but it has a very, very high usage of the BART station. So I think you have to examine each case in particular to make that statement. Yeah. And I think it will find that the mature neighborhoods that are not PDAs, because they are considered built out, are very heavily using the transit stations.
Yeah, thank you for that clarification. Alicia, Pat, and Tom. So that's the sequence I got. So somebody else?
This discussion about having the PDAs, many cities had PDAs before it was popular to have PDAs, and they were already doing this, doing the right thing. And then the RENA numbers and so on. There's many cities that will never, ever have PDAs and that will never reach their RENA numbers because of, you know, the geography, the history. There are many BART stations that I know in my county that there's no place for them to build on those. I think what I look at this is that this is a way of setting a guideline, and it also connects it to the last mile, where I think where my colleague, Commissioner Hagerty, was saying about bicycles. Well, you know, we've always, with transit, we talk about the last mile. Well, everybody can get there. So this, I think, is a guideline to say how are we going to go with future PDAs that make it easier for that, whether it's pedestrian, whether it's bicycles, and people that need more time or less time. So I don't think it's mandating to any city or any county to say this is the way you have to do it, but it's a guideline. It's a guideline that can be a little bit flexible because just, you know, as I'm thinking of where BART stations are throughout the Bay Area, I know there are some areas that there's just no way, whether it's the zoning, whether where it is or because it's already built out or because of the type of homes that are around it. So I see this as a guideline for it and connecting it to that whole concept of the last mile when we have the quarter mile of building PDAs.
Thank you. Pat?
Thank you very much, Chair Spearing, and thank you, Ken and Miriam, for and Mark, for the explanation. It really helps make it a little bit clearer. I guess I'm still not sure why we couldn't give a community the flexibility to have a PDA that is a mile radius if, in fact, that particular community would like to have a PDA that large. That would possibly include multiple transit stops and or a large use of bicycles, because I think the example at the ABAG Executive Board was used in Dublin where that community might like to have a larger PDA. So what's the disadvantage for ABAG to give that flexibility and say that a PDA could be a half a mile or a mile radius depending on what the community wants, especially if PDAs are really self-nominated and self-proposed by the community?
I guess, one thing is, in this example, is one no because it's a transit station. If we have a bus route, obviously you will have potentially multiple circles at each bus stop. So it doesn't have to be a circle. It can be more linear. The intent of the priority development areas is to link access to transit, access to alternative modes of transportation with housing. And this criteria of the half mile, based on our conversations with MTC, is what's best supported by the research in terms of what people might be willing to walk or bike and make the effort to shift from car to transit. I guess we would have to do a more specific survey to see if the local residents of a particular area might be willing to walk longer distances and might be willing to shift from car to transit to have further considerations. But I guess I will invite Kent to comment on that.
I think it, as somebody who was around back when the PDAs were set up, I mean, I think it goes back to what they were for. I mean, it was really trying to get the region away from a project-by-project approach to transit-oriented development, where we had an individual apartment building or a condominium development being built somewhere near a BART station, but with no amenities in the neighborhood, no real neighborhood plan to implement the place as a neighborhood to create the connectivity and to direct regional investment in a much more strategic way. And I think that the framework has worked pretty well in that regard. I mean, a lot of the specific plans that were established early on in San Francisco are now places that are booming because there was a lot of hard work that went into establishing the neighborhood amenities, the walkability in a transit-oriented area. As Miriam suggested, you can still have, provided you have the transit, an area larger than a half-mile circumference. If you look at, there are significant areas of San Francisco, really most of the city would meet this criteria because Muni is so extensive. The city hasn't chosen to nominate all of those areas, and that's a local prerogative. But as my boss suggested, you have to draw the line someplace, and based upon the national research through many universities, through the Transportation Research Board, through Urban Land Institute and other groups, this is where most initiatives like this set their guidelines. And if we were to go in a different direction, we would have a transit criteria for the PDAs that's distinct from some of MTC's existing policies, such as the TOD policy, from the cap and trade framework that the state's established, from SB 375 and the transit project priority areas that were established through the legislation, which is fundamental to our regional planning effort. So we think this is a better way to go, but ultimately it's your call.
Okay. All right, Tom Azambrato, Jake, and then Julie.
Tom Azambrato, HUD rep. I actually think this is a really important discussion, and I appreciate all the planning studies, and you didn't mention Doxiadis and others who basically use that distance. But I think as we're going, as we look at 2040 and the number of low-income folks, there's not going to necessarily be a choice in terms of what your walking abilities are. I grew up in public housing in New York, and the subway was a mile away. We walked. I'm upper middle income, and I happen to be a mile away from BART. I walk by choice, but I'm older, over 60, and I'm not in good health. So there's a lot of people who can do this, but I think we will, as a society, especially in the Bay Area, be doing this more in the future, because first, poor aren't going to have cars. If we're projecting the cost of housing and transportation for them to be reduced 10%, the way we're doing that is eliminating cars. And walking is going to be what you do. Now, if you walk a mile and it's 20 minutes, but I wait 20 minutes for a bus, at what point do I decide to walk? The other thing is, as a society, and the studies were based a lot on middle-income lifestyles. If you look at low-income lifestyles, whether in Mexico City, whether in the Bay Area and other places around the country, people walk. I believe when BART was perceived, it was never perceived that we would stand on BART. Everyone had a seat. Now we design it during rush hour, the majority of us stand. Now, in 1950 and 60, when we planned BART that way, you would have been laughed out. And now we accept it as a given that we stand. And, you know, the little incremental thing with giving a dollar fee at Concord and others is fine. All we need to do is you price that $10 down the road, people a half mile to a mile are going to walk. The other thing from it, when we look at supply, if we keep it the half mile radius, are we actually controlling supply of available land and then promoting NIMBYism because you're outside the half mile? And if you potentially look at increasing it, we are actually now identifying more where low-income and moderate-income can live, and because it's already built into a framework. The other thing, my concern with TARDs are that when you're next to transit-oriented development, it can't be perceived as low-income. Low-income aren't excluded, but you want a mixture of market and low-income. And when you look at Fruitdale, the low-income aren't right next to BART. It's market. And the low-income are on a little bit of the outskirts. And again, from an economic reality, if you're low-income, you're doing more work walking. And frankly, we all should be doing more walking. So as a society, will we start to change that perception? But going back to the point of, did we consider if you increase the area, the radius, what that potentially does to supply and actually have it easier to get the public to accept the buy-in? And you don't keep the density, the full mile radius. You recognize some concentric limits to density as you expand it out. But that you say, no, this is still, they're still using transportation. And as we looked at Pleasant Hill, I think at one point we said only 40% are using mass transit at their TODs anyway. It's double what we normally expect. But by the year 2040, you would hope that, you know, more than 40% would be using mass transit as we're next to TODs. Anyway.
I need to add another point here, because these are not transit usage areas. We're not trying to define PDAs by transit usage as though people who are outside the boundaries can't access transit. Of course they can. These are community plans. These are specific plans that the local government is willing to engage in to increase densities around these particular areas that have the potential for higher transit usage as one criteria, but other criteria meaning that there's available land, that there's a willingness of the neighborhood to work with the city to develop a community plan. And what goes into that community plan are many different factors. Part of it is the access to transit, but other parts are access to greenways or access to community facilities or placemaking, places where people can congregate. A lot goes into the planning function that says this is where we want our city to plan a neighborhood plan, a community plan. And they define that partially by access to transit, which is why it comes to us, because there was a joint interest in the part of MTC to do a reduction in transportation usage of the automobile, and they had some funds available, and the idea that we needed higher quality community planning instead of project-by-project planning, which was subject to a lot of NIMBYism. So within these community plans, we're going to have a higher degree of entitlement efficiency, for example, the creation of infrastructure financing districts, other kinds of things that will be supportive of a community plan. So that's a really big reason why we have PDAs, is to develop that framework. And transit is an important part of it, but it is not the definition of what we're doing.
Okay, I have Jake, Julie, and Doreen.
Mr. Chair, I come to sing an old song one more time. The old song is that SB 375 doesn't have sticks, it has carrots. What are the carrots? We all know what the carrots are. The carrots are money. Runner Park has a PDA which is not circular. In fact, it's triangular. But we did apply through the existing PDA definitions. We had made a conscious choice as a city council that our smart station location would not be at the north end of the city of Runner Park because, frankly, we were told you'll never meet the requirements to get the carrot stuff, the money stuff. And then as we looked at that, it certainly made sense to myself and my colleagues that there was existing ridership within the quote-unquote half-mile radius. But given the geography and the trigonometry, or whatever you want to call it, of the railroad tracks, the main east-west arterial Runner Park Expressway, our 180-acre PDA is triangular. It did qualify. We did meet these criteria. We did, as far as SMART was concerned, then create a station that is going to have the sort of ridership that we envision. So I'm quite comfortable with the concept that we will continue the existing definitions of PDA because there's been demonstrated flexibility on the part of the people who examined our requests for money, and we're happily engaged in planning that area with a $500,000 planning grant. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Julie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions first, and then I do have some comments as well. Is it critical that we make a decision on this today?
It will be important to... That was the process that was established at the executive board, so it will be important to have this PDA criteria settle at the next executive board meeting.
What I'm getting from my colleagues is some questions about it, and personally, I have no issues with the half-mile radius. I think there were some logical reasons for doing that in the first place. And this goes to my comments. Number one, it's all about local control anyway. You can have a PDA or not have a PDA. If you want to qualify for the incentive for the funding, then you have to have your PDA within a half mile of transit. That's one of our criteria that we have established. That's not to say that a local jurisdiction might choose to have what we would call a PDA without the transit piece in their downtown. They may choose to densify their downtown and make it more walkable. If they're clustering around their historic area and that sort of thing, they can choose to put that kind of density anywhere they want to put it. It just doesn't qualify for PDA incentive funding. So we're not taking away local control. The only thing we're doing is saying because we don't have unlimited pots of money and because one of the charges that we have under SB 375 that created this thing in the first place is to encourage locations near transit to have higher density to hopefully encourage more use of transit and to reduce greenhouse gases. That's part of the logic in this. That doesn't necessarily mean that's the only place we will have these things done. And I guess we have to go back in history a little bit, but obviously some transit stations are never going to have a PDA because they're in the middle of existing development that has been there for some time historically. And frankly, even though some of those have more traditional densities and they don't have high densities, some of those transit stations are actually very heavily used. And I can point to my neighbor here in Orinda. I drive by that BART station on my way to these meetings every time, and even at noon, in the middle of a workday, those platforms are full of people. So those folks are using the transit station even though there's not high density around it. So, you know, I think we need to allow that not all high density development is going to be within half mile of transit. That's fine. That's local control. But in order to manage the resources that we have available, I think the definition of the half mile of transit is still a reasonable one, and that may mean that it's a long oblong piece because geography is going to weigh on part of that. I can think of in my county the Hercules rail station, right, where you've got the Delta on one side, you know, and they plan to have a ferry stop there. Well, obviously they're not going to build on the water. So there, and then they've got other issues too with highways and stuff like that. So obviously it's going to be long and skinny, but we have provided that the area outside that half mile is eligible for connective money. So, you know, we're not restricting it to only within that half mile. We're saying, you know, it can be within that half mile, but it can be longer than that as well. So I'm fine with adopting this the way it stands today.
Okay, good. I would like to see that we move this forward today and don't put it off. And so I appreciate that comment. Doreen, and is there anybody else that wants to David, anyone else other than? Okay, so, all right. So I'll get right around. Go ahead, Doreen.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that we are all keep in mind conversations that we've had in the past that it's important to keep in mind that people that for the foreseeable future we're going to be seeing the working force get older and older and older. And the ability of people, of workers, to walk long distances and bike is going to be significantly different for workers in their 20s and 30s than it is for workers in their 50s, 60s, and even 70s.
Thank you. David, Sam, and then Tom Bates. David?
Great. Thank you very much. I think we'd all agree that PDAs throughout the nine Bay Area counties, the 190 PDAs are different depending on their location. Certainly what happens within San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose, and the more urbanized areas are going to be vastly different than what happens perhaps here in Windsor, as an example. I also think that the mode of transport really differentiates that too. So I would encourage us to maintain that flexibility. You know, I'm a Smart Board member, totally supportive of the system, but at the same time, it's a heavy rail system. And so, and we're struggling with this in San Rafael about putting a senior housing alongside the track. Is that the best place for that senior housing? Probably not. It should be slightly pulled away. Certainly, if you're a BART underground BART station, you know, housing all over the place is wonderful. So I think it does make a difference. And as long as we can maintain that flexibility and really understand that, and how that gets worded in there, and I'm not sure if it should be half mile radius with a not to exceed on the other side. That's something that, you know, but I don't want to tie our hands, but I think that I want to ensure that that flexibility can maintain going forward.
Now, David, don't forget a lot of us seniors are hard of hearing, so next to the tracks isn't a problem.
I've heard that one on this particular piece. And
Sam.
If they're not now, they soon will be.
Just a quick question. Forgive me if you've said this already, but as I look at the report on page 2, there's a description of how the definition near transit changed in 2010 and that there had been grandfathering of PDAs that didn't qualify. So of the 120 or so PDAs we've got, how many would be grandfathered under the newer definition?
I'm turning to Miriam.
Based on the analysis we've done, most of our PDAs higher than 90% will qualify under that criteria. I think when we changed the criteria is when we started getting PDAs that had slightly different components. For example, in the case of American Canyon, and American Canyon developed an agreement with the transit agency to increase the frequency of ridership in order to qualify as a PDA.
Thank you.
Okay, Tom? Mayor Bates?
Thank you. Thank you very much. So I'll be brief. First of all, I wanted to point out that the walkability issue around transit is extremely important. For instance, in my city of Berkeley, homes that sell on the flats sell for more money now than homes on the hills. If you have a home with a view of the San Francisco Bay, it actually sells for less than a place you can buy on the flats because people want to walk. They want that walkability. They want the ability not to have to drive up and down the hills and do all the shopping. They want to be able to go right there. So it's coming. It's a future. It's coming. The other thing is, it's mentioned, the young people are not getting driver's license, let alone cars. They're not even bothering to get driver's license. They're getting identification cards. More and more people are saying, we don't need cars. We don't want cars. So I think that's an interesting phenomenon. In 1995, I offered the legislation that created what we call transit villages, and that was the first of what became PDAs, and it was within a quarter of a mile. The idea was 10,000 people within a quarter of a mile, because that's what the research said. And then we're now talking about half a mile. I'm not necessarily opposed to that. And now other people are raising the issue, well, maybe it could even be further. And I think Tom Amiato made some points that I need to think about the gentrification and also the moving of the poor people. So I think what we need in the future is to think about is concentric circles. Like, obviously, if we have it within a development within a quarter of a mile, it's the best. It's because we know it's that people are going to use it. They're going to use the transit. If you go out a half a mile, there's less people are going to use it. And you go a mile even further. So maybe we have to have degrees of support for those various communities as you go out. And then lastly, I have a station. I was surprised. I guess the PDA for North Berkeley is not a station. But what our policies are, as we're now in the process, we'll never be able to upzone. And by the way, just a caveat, upzoning is not a slam dunk for any stretch of the imagination. We did that in our downtown. People tried to change that. Luckily, 74% of the people said, no, we want that. That's a trend we want to keep going. But so what we're doing now to try to intensify development around the BART stations that won't allow upzoning, which are single family, is we're going with this thing called an alternative planning unit development, an ADU, which is by right, 75 square foot building could be built on the property. So we can intensify the density around that area and provide people the opportunity to do that. And then we have a caveat with our proposal, which is you can't use it for short term rental. So we're not interested in setting up a lot of people just to have Airbnbs. But that's a way to intensify the development and not have the upzone.
Thank you, Tom. And Amy, hopefully you're clean up here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You have something new to offer.
Well, I kind of have an additional comment. I think wanted to pick up really on what Commissioner Bates was talking about, sort of this concentric development and recognizing in our nine Bay Area counties, we're going to have a different character of PDAs. You know, you have the urban PDA and the suburban PDA, and they will look and feel differently because of the character of each individual city and neighborhoods within a city. I guess one of the things that I'd hope that we could continue to look at is the requirements for the bus requirements, because those are very flexible, and I think as we look to development, Commissioner Wiener's concerns about looking at the housing production. You know, are we really producing the housing in these PDAs? Are we achieving the goals? And it seems to me that we want to provide the incentive for as many communities as possible to do PDA development, and a number of those communities have bus access, and that rather than looking at a fixed headway, look at what is an appropriate headway within that system. In other words, urban headways, urban transit agencies have, bus agencies have intense headways. As you move out into the suburban areas, achieving 20-minute headways may be absolutely not feasible, and yet there are communities that are well-positioned, again, within that mile of rail transit or, connecting bus to rail, maybe places where PDA developments would be desirable and the financial incentives that come with that. So I know that this is something you've grappled with, but I'd really like us to really consider that transit requirements, especially around buses, because I think that may be a future opportunity for the region as well as local communities that would like to develop around some of those resources.
Right, I'll just add, when the transit criteria was updated back in 2010, that was actually the primary focus of the discussions in this room. It wasn't so much the circumference from transit. It was for bus during peak hour commutes, what should the headways be? And again, looking at a lot of national research, 20-minute headways during peak hour commutes was what we arrived at. That is something we monitor. And that's where there are places in the region that aren't, the local jurisdiction hasn't chosen to nominate because that's their choice. They do meet that headway, and that's something we track and we'll track with the plan going forward.
Well, I guess to that point, again, transit, if you know what transit is reliable, people will plan around the times. You know, they don't necessarily expect to be able to walk out the front door and have a bus right there. That they'll plan, okay, if it's an 8 o'clock, real-time transit, you can plan and say, okay, I'll walk out because I know the bus is coming at this time. So headways, you know, perhaps become less and less relevant as people can plan their trips around known what they know the resources to be. But I know cities that have been interested in developing PDAs but haven't been able to because of that very narrow criteria around bus transit. So, you know, the whole point is we want to encourage the development as if cities want to do it. So I would hate that to be a barrier, you know, going forward. So,
Scott, did you have a brief closing?
I have a very brief comment.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I appreciate some of the response to the comments I made about the BART stations. I mean, no one, obviously, when you have well-developed neighborhoods, no one's suggesting you can somehow magically come in and change 100 years worth of development patterns. And actually, Mayor Bates and I must be telepathically linked, because I was thinking, when you look at, for example, accessory dwelling units or cottages, there are still ways that communities can do that. And actually, we're doing that in my district, in parts of the district that can't have big buildings, but we're being more flexible for in-law units. And then, you know, you're right, some of the stations, like, say, Rock Ridge or others that may have high ridership despite low density, I think a lot of that is people that are driving to BART frequently, and sometimes there are these parking lots, and that's great. It's better to drive a couple miles to a BART station than to drive 20 miles to commute. But as Commissioner Zambrano mentioned, you know, there are, you know, people who aren't going to be able to do the car thing or for whatever reason can't afford a car, and just having the option so that you have people who are still driving to the BART station but also people who are going to be able to walk.
Thank you. Dwayne DeWitt. Dwayne, you want to come forward? Thank you for your patience.
Oh, my pleasure. And
thank you for traveling down.
Hello. I'm Dwayne DeWitt from Roseland, and up on that map right behind here about Bay Area suburbanization of poverty is where my disadvantaged community can be seen up in Santa Rosa. I'm glad you folks have a PDA program. I'm glad you've talked about this in depth. And I just want you to have some sticks also, because I know some folks that just go for carrots, and that's where my neighborhood's gotten wrapped up in this. Specifically, what I have done since the Roseland Community-Based Transportation Plan, which I was a member of in 2007, is I've gotten a graduate degree in city planning. I've done postgraduate work in Northern Europe and in Scandinavia to study bus and transit systems and how they're used well. You can't just say we're going to do this and then everybody's going to get on the bus. Up where I live, vehicle miles traveled and the people using their private vehicles is increasing out in the nice area of the Roseland PDA. So there's not going to be a change if the community and its land use people don't upzone. And what's happened just recently is proposals have come in to downzone land right there next to where the PDA has been proposed. So I'm hoping that you folks, in your esteemed wisdom, all of you, especially Mr. Haggerty, probably the smartest guy in the room, that
I
put
that.
That out there, you guys.
Oh,
there's
your,
some fun
your
credibility
to this. Is just,
because yeah. Here's the thing. He knows the real-world situation from his district and how people will react, all right? So you can have all the policy wonks in the world that you want talking about what you think is going to happen because of your peer-reviewed study. But if you can't get the boy on the bus, it's not happening. All right? So that may be too simple for all of us, but it's so important.
No.
Now, this Roseland Project Area Committee, just 15 more seconds.
Okay, go ahead.
It has a commercial corridor. It has smart rail just to the south of there. So I'd like to ask you to let me come down here during public appearances with my own PowerPoint presentation for 3 minutes to show you what can be done and how it can be done better than some folks would take your money and run with. Thank you.
All right. Very well said. Mark. Mark Green.
Mark Green. So if I've never in 20 years been in a room where Haggerty's been called the smartest guy in the room, but I guess it was a first for everything.
Thanks for changing that
for
20 years.
Every 20 years it happens. A couple of weeks ago, I was at a BART retreat, and I think it's on point with this quarter half mile discussion, because I don't know if either MTC or ABAG staff or how many commissioners here are aware of this, but BART did at their retreat mention that they've had their own research showing that in terms of rental income, leasing income, and even detached sales on the resale value, that when the quarter mile of many of their stations are getting double-digit increases over what's next in line, and then at the one-quarter to one-half mile, they're still getting an increase. It does decrease after the one-half mile radius. The point there being, I think, that as BART expands into Fremont, it expands into Santa Clara County and into San Jose. It goes into eastern Contra Costa County with eBART and hopefully at some point into eastern Alameda County with Livermore, not to mention how many tubes we're going to get into San Francisco at some point. But I do think from a money standpoint, if BART is sitting on a cash cow, which they admit they are in many cases around these stations, is in terms of housing and in terms of transportation, to me there seems to be some nexus that ABAG and MTC should be looking at, that if BART's in these areas and it's by their own statistics producing greater income for the landlords and developers in those areas, I think it's worth looking at some way to tap in to that revenue stream. That's what would be my suggestion. And then secondly, I think the average human speed walking, terrain, wind speed, age, on and on and on, is like 3.1 miles an hour, which means you can do a mile in 19 minutes and 22 seconds, which will get you 10 minutes. So I would consider the BART, or at least looking with BART staff on that.
Okay, I want to thank all the committee members. The great conversation, good information. This is an item for the ABAG Administrative Committee, and I'm going to move that we approve the criteria to establish and refine the Bay Area priority development areas.
Second.
We have a motion and a second.
No. This is ABAG admin.
No, that's so, right. Go ahead.
So I need the motion to be by an ABAG admin member.
I am a member.
You are. You
I am
but
a
the
member.
Second
that's,
was not.
That's
so.
Why. Okay.
So do I have a second from? And who did that come from? Dave Cortese. Very good.
So just can I?
Yes.
So
comment?
Is it that we recommend to the full board? Is that the motion?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. That's correct.
That is the motion. That we move this recommendation as a recommendation to the full executive board of ABAG, and we'll have further discussion there, yeah. I am sure.
Okay? I kind of don't understand the motion, though, because quite frankly, Madam Chair, we're really changing nothing.
We're recommending that it stay the same.
Yeah, so...
The question came from the Regional Planning Committee
and
from prior executive board discussion. So we are just reaffirming
that recommendation. Let's just move it along.
Okay. So
no, I know.
ABAG executive board, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. We have, and any abstentions? Okay. Seeing none. Very good. It passes. Thank you. We will recommend that to the full executive board.
Okay, I have no speaker cards on public comments, and thank you, staff. Good presentation, and this meeting's adjourned.